All right, we are back and better than ever for this edition of the D2D3 pod. We were off for a week as we kind of sorted through our new situation, and I had to find a new pod partner. But fortunately for the people, I found one, and I went and replaced the second biggest Wesleyan fan I know with the first biggest Wesleyan fan I know. So as that may be, we are here and we are ready to do this thing. So if you haven't picked up on it by now, Kyle is not going to be part of the D2D3 pod at Inside the Cross anymore. He has moved on. He's on a new situation with the New England Lax Journal. So that's great. We wish him the best. And in his place, I have Jack Rabba. Jack, how you doing?
Doing good, Dan. Thanks for having me. I will say everyone you have done this show with has gone on to do some pretty special things. So hopefully I could just carry on that torch, and there's definitely some elite company there.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this will not be a permanent thing for Jack. Jack is with Inside the Cross right now on sort of a part-time intern basis. So Jack obviously is not currently enrolled at Wesleyan. It is not on their team right now. He's working with us, and we are lucky to have him. So, Jack, why don't you tell us a little bit about kind of your role and what you're doing with Inside the Cross right now?
Yeah. So I decided not to go back to school this semester with the uncertainty of the NESCAC season. So rather than sitting at home, kind of always knew I wanted to get into something professionally in the lacrosse world. So I figured take a shot in the dark, reach out to Inside Lacrosse. And fortunately, I've been taken on as an intern through the spring and the summer, which has been awesome. So far I've been assisting the high school and recruiting side of things with Ty Zanders. We've been attending some high school games in the area, which has been pretty cool for me because I'm pretty green to the whole MIA landscape.
If you aren't familiar with going to all these MIA games, I haven't really been able to go to them until this year between obviously coaching at York, and then when I was living in Maryland before that, I was also playing at the same time that they were. So I was never really able to get to them. This year, I've gone to 5 or 6, and man, are they entertaining. I also caught Bullis and Georgetown Prep, and gosh, some of those games, they're just played at such high levels. It's really, really entertaining stuff. So that's pretty cool that you're able to come down and do that and fill that role. And we're lucky to have you helping out in that and doing some of that IL prep stuff, which is one more Inside the Cross account that if you're not following, you should be. Again, that's IL preps, and it's all sorts of coverage on the high school landscape and upcoming recruits and all that type of stuff, which is great. And so that's what we're going to have Jack doing here. All right. And we're going to bounce now and start to kind of focus on some more stuff surrounding Jack, at least for a couple more minutes. And then we'll get to some game review. We'll get to some weekend coverage. We'll get to some of these D1 versus D3 crossover games. All right. So we got a big full episode coming your way. All right. So Jack, everybody's probably wondering pretty much the exact same thing, but I am very curious to know, and I'm definitely going to get to the national championship here, but that's going to be its own question of itself. But what was it like growing up in the house that you did with your dad being a coach and, you know, going through all this? What was it like?
Yeah. So I think it was a real unique experience that I wouldn't really trade for anything. First, I'll say growing up as a son of a coach, it's really benefited me as a player, I think. First and foremost, like going to practices, sitting in on film sessions, going to recruiting events with him. I think from an early age, it kind of taught me the commitment and drive that's required to play at like a high level. And I think also too, just the knowledge of the game that I have, I think I can credit that just to kind of being around the program. And also being around my dad's program up at Wesleyan. It was always great growing up. I've always felt like I had 55 older brothers. So it was neat in that way. I had some mentors early on in my life that really helped mold me. And I'm really appreciative for those guys.
Were you just like running around on campus? Like there's practice going on, but you're on the practice field over there, just getting shots up or something.
Yeah, I mean, any chance I could get, I was getting over to campus and being around the guys, hanging out in the locker room. I'm sure talking to some of those guys, you know, I was like all over them and maybe even a little annoying at times, but I couldn't get enough of it. Looking back on it now, like if I had the chance to do that and help a kid out, like I totally get, I would jump at it because it totally helped me. And but yeah, like I said, I was over there any chance I can get, always kind of jumping at the opportunity. That was always like a big deal for me. So that was awesome. And then so obviously my dad coaches there, and the player coach relationship's always been interesting between us. So he was always my club coach growing up, and he was actually my youth football coach as well. So, because obviously no fall ball in the NESCAC, so he was able to do that.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So when I made the move, the idea of playing for him wasn't completely foreign to me. So I kind of knew what that would be about. And I think his thing, his MO has always kind of been, he's always been pretty fair. He's always definitely been tough on me. He's always kind of been harder on me than maybe he is on some of the other guys. And I think that's just because he expects the most out of me. And I think anytime you come into a program at any level and there's a coach's son, right, there's always some skepticism naturally that like guys are like, okay, is he just going to get handed things? And is he just getting this and that because like he's the coach's son, which is easy, you know, it's an easy point to make. And I think I'd rather have it the way that it is, just because I think I have to kind of earn everything and earn the respect of my teammates first and foremost before anything else. So
right. Yeah, no, I kind of know that feeling. My older brother was my basketball coach growing up in high school, and there were definitely times where it was like I could not get away. I realized in hindsight, like I was not getting away with a single thing. And one time in PE class, you know, the beeper test, where you like the pacer test.
Yeah.
So one time I like did the bare minimum to get like whatever healthy is for your age group. And right. By the time I got to my next class, he was sitting outside my door, out of the door to my next classroom. Like, dude, that's not how we do things. So I kind of get what you're saying. I know that that's probably a little bit tougher, which honestly is probably better. It'll make you better for it. And it's definitely better in the eyes of the teammates to know that, you know, the coach's son isn't getting something. And just because of that, he's getting it. Probably like harsher judgment and harder treatment. So that's probably pretty cool. But one good thing that I'm really excited to have you on for are these D1, D3 crossovers. It couldn't be better timing to get you on for this. And so Jack, if you aren't aware, had some experience before his time at Wesleyan before transferring there. He, out of high school, went to Loyola. So he's going to be one of the best sources we could possibly find to talk about these D1, D3 crossovers. But before we get to those games specifically, I'm curious your opinion on kind of one specific thing that you think makes the biggest difference at the Division I level versus Division III level.
All right, so I think it's tough to narrow it down to one.
That's why I made that the question.
I was able to narrow it down to two things, so you're going to have to bear with me there.
All right, that's fine. I'll take it.
I think the first thing that's noticeable is the depth on every team in Division I, top to bottom. Those bottom players on those Division I teams, like the bottom guys on the bottom of the rosters, are still really great lacrosse players. Right. Like, they would be tremendous at a lot of schools. Terrific high school players. And obviously, like, those schools are getting the pick of the litter. So there's just good kids coming in every year. So I would say the overall depth of those teams is a little noticeable. And then I would say second is athletically. I will say there is for obvious reasons, there is a noticeable difference between a NESCAC midfielder and a midfielder at Duke and Notre Dame. Like, that's just natural though, right? Because they're going to have their first pick a litter, and they're going to get those kids and the top athletes in the country. So I think athletically, there's a bit of a gap there. and I think the depth too of rosters top to bottom.
Yeah.
And I'll get into that even with some of those crossover games. I think it was pretty pertinent in some of those games. So
yeah, definitely. No, I think that makes sense. I think in watching, obviously having played at or coached at both levels, but in watching, one of the biggest things that to me is like you can tell a Division One player from a Division Three player at times is simply as, and specifically I'll use a midfielder, is simply like when they get hands free in a step down, the ball is buried. It's an extra 10 miles per hour harder, and it's an extra inch in the corner, you know, and like those differences are huge. And a lot of times I'm going to get to it, but there was one team that I have a particular interest in that did not shoot particularly well, but had they had, you know, a couple of those like Division One shooters, it's a totally different game. And that's really the biggest difference in my eyes. One of the biggest differences in my eyes is like, if you give up a 15 yard step down at Division One, you're holding your breath because that ball might get like just roasted off the pipe. We're in Division Three, if you give up a 15-yard step down, you're like, all right, I think my goalie's got a good shot at saving this. And so that's one big thing. But I think you kind of hit it with – oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I will say, too, though, like if I think if you threw a bunch of D3 guys in a Division One practice or vice versa, D1 guys in a D3 practice, and you put them in line drills or put them in stick work, whatever it may be, just like drill work and – I don't think you'd be able to pick out really from that who the Division One kid is, who the Division Three kid is.
Totally. There's definitely a skill level that there's kind of like a balance at some point. And I feel that way at some point where if you took a Division One player and just kind of put him in to a D3 practice, and then you had a Division One coach watch and say, like, pick out the kid that belongs on your team, it would mostly be an eye test of looking at him like, okay, well, that kid's like size and speed and athleticism would help him fit in more so than it's like he's that much more skilled than the rest of the team.
Right. And I think, too, like those top tier teams in Division Three, like, you know, at the year at least Wesleyan won the championship, they have guys like Ron Jacoby, who's going on to play at Rutgers next year for his fifth year. I think in order to win a championship in Division Three, you can't do it without Division One level players. And I think that's just the truth. Like, you got to have dudes who could, like, Division One level players to win a D3 championship. And I think that's something that, you know, those top programs everywhere are a big believer in, and they're getting out there and trying to go after those kids.
Yeah, the world of, and we could do a whole separate pod on this, maybe we should one day, but the world of players that fall in the category of like, I could go and be at a mid-tier Division One or a low-tier Division One and kind of fit in on that roster versus go to a high-level Division Three and get playing time as a sophomore and fight for a championship. Like, we could do a whole pod on that itself, but I think that argument is something that's really intriguing. And it honestly, I think it comes down to like, the kid itself, or himself, and I guess I shouldn't say itself, but the kid himself, right? What does he prioritize? Is it facilities? Is it camaraderie? Is it, you know, whatever it is? And it comes down to that. But there are so many instances. There are so many instances of kids that are on those rosters at some of those mid-tier Division One schools that are never ultimately going to get a whole bunch of playing time that could be fighting and playing for a championship in Division Three.
And then there's also, too, I feel like there's been so many success stories. You look at D3, I think a lot of these guys land at some of these places just because, frankly, they're overlooked in high school, you know, and then they go on, maybe they're a late bloomer, and then they go on to have success in college and maybe even at the pro level. I mean, look at it, guys this year, like fifth years, Kevin Rogers, right? You know, he's going on and having a tremendous year at a high point, and wouldn't be shocked if he's an All-American at the end of the year and gets an opportunity in the pros. But there's plenty of those guys. Maybe they just got a little overlooked in high school, and I think we're going to start to see less and less of that just because the recruiting rules have changed, right? There's not as much early recruiting, and I think the D3 guys were able to land some of the guys were a little more under the radar because of that. So maybe we'll go away from that a little bit, but it's been cool to see some of these stories historically, I think.
Absolutely. Definitely. All right, let's get to some of these games that we saw this weekend. We'll go specifically and start with the D1-D3 crossover games. And I want to start with, obviously, the loss in D3 Nation, Penn versus Cabrini. I'm not sure that anybody was particularly thinking it was going to go too much differently that has been paying a whole bunch of attention to Cabrini this year. They are just so loaded on the opposite side of the ball that they have to play a whole bunch against teams that can work with them at the face-off and compete with them athletically. They do a great job in the ride of turning you over, and they do a great job of creating some chaos, and they do that so that they can try and keep the ball in their dangerous sticks as much as possible. But unfortunately, that's not going to work all the time, and it's not going to work against teams like Salisbury, where we saw it didn't work, and clearly against Penn, who it did not work against as well. They did do a good job in the first two quarters of kind of keeping it close and pushing, and again, they do have success when they get the ball on offense, but as we kind of hit earlier, Penn was just another level of athletic and skill that Cabrini just couldn't quite match. Jack, what'd you think of this one? I know you got to watch it as well.
Yeah. I mean, first off, I think I was really impressed with the way Cabrini came out in this one. Historically a tough and scrappy team, and they're unwilling to back down to anyone. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Salisbury or Penn being put in front of them, they're going to always come out and fight. So, I mean, it was 6-5 late in the second quarter. And like we're talking about earlier, I think the depth thing and athletically, the wheels kind of fell off there for Cabrini. But credit to those guys for battling and scrapping. I mean, Penn's been a top dog in Division I now for the last couple of years. So, I mean, they were playing. It wasn't like they were playing any slouches.
Penn looked awesome. We're going to get to tough Dartmouth, where I do not feel that way about Dartmouth. I did not think Dartmouth was very good. And their turnover numbers indicate that as well. But I mean, Penn looked really good.
I mean, Penn has a lot of guys back, you know, a lot of returners, guys who have played meaningful minutes for them over the last couple of years. And I mean, realistically, just look, you know, they're a goal away from a Final Four in 2019. So that is one of the best teams in the country. Credit to Cabrini and coach for taking on that challenge and putting on a great crossover game for the fans. I know us D3 guys always love watching that kind of stuff. So hopefully we can.
I'd love to see it kind of become a yearly thing. You know, like we could name it some sort of like Philly challenge. Kyle Devitt, my ex-host, loves naming games. So we could call this like the cheesesteak battle, the D1-D3 cheesesteak battle or something like that. Battle of Philly. All right, let's go to the other one. Tufts 15, Dartmouth 9. Jack, I'll defer to you. This is up there by you. You know these teams pretty well. What'd you think of this one?
Yeah. So, I mean, Tufts is obviously having a terrific year. Real experienced team with a handful of, you know, there's a ton of fifth years and seniors who have played meaningful minutes in the past, and now it's all paying dividends, I think, for them. Super well coached. You know, obviously people see the transition game and the chaos, but I really think it is organized chaos. And I think people mistake that at times. They're really organized in what they do. I don't know about you, but I think it was interesting to see them. It was one of the only times this year I really felt like they were kind of hit with some adversity. They started down 3-1 and they're able to kind of rally and respond. So that was, you know, good to see. And I think a positive for Tufts, especially in this one. They were able to score more goals in 6-on-6 than they've usually been able to. You know, they've been relying on scoring a bulk of their goals in transition. And I think Dartmouth did a fairly good job of stopping some transition opportunities. And they were forced to score some more in 6-on-6. Shout out to Daniel Hanks. I got to give one to the goalie for Dartmouth. You know, factor in a couple pipes there. Daniel Hanks, the goalie, he had 16 saves at the half. which is pretty remarkable. And looking at the game, I thought the one way that Dartmouth could pull this thing out is if Hink stood on his head, which he did, and if they could control the X, and they're able to do that too, but still, it just wasn't enough to get the job done. But credit to Dartmouth for taking the game. Just great to see them playing this spring. Any thoughts, Dan? I mean,
yeah. So I definitely was really impressed with Dartmouth's goalie, but that was kind of where like my impressiveness with them stopped. The number of turnovers made me think that they were like trying to lose at times, but that was also part of, you know, a really strong ride from Tufts, and they get after it in the ride with their attack.
So I was going to bring that up too. So Dartmouth was 19 of 27 clearing.
Right. Which lends itself to those transition goals that you're talking about. Like it's one thing to stop transition off after an offensive possession. You know, you can pretty reasonably do that. Get a midfielder to drop in the hole, send someone to the box, your LSM drops quickly, you know, like hustle through it, be urgent. You can pretty much do that pretty well. Stopping transition after a failed clear is basically impossible. You have a defender that probably ran to the box. You have LSM that's ran 60 yards away from the goal if he's stretching deep. Your D-mids are all jacked up. They're tired. They just played a full possession on defense. They just tried to clear it. Now they're stuck. And, you know, like stopping transition in those instances is impossible. And that was where they got him a couple times, which was good. Yeah. I also thought you hit the nail on the head with a little bit of adversity in the beginning of the game. And then Wildbaum hits the first goal of the game. And you could almost see their bench just, like, take that sigh of relief where it was like, okay, we can score. Like, these guys do bleed the same blood that we do. And then it kind of escalated from there. And then there was that run in the second quarter where they did force a couple fail clears, hit some transition, go make it take it once or twice. And then it was like you blinked and a 3-3 game turned to 6-3 or 8-3 or 8-5 or whatever it got to. It was really interesting to see how that played out. And it could have been a lot worse if Dartmouth doesn't make 20 saves. Right.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think one thing too, which was just kind of a notable takeaway, Tufts was 10 for 28 at the X. You know, they got beat up there, and I know their starter didn't play. I know he got banged up a little bit in the Wesleyan game. But looking at it from afar, or just overlooking the whole thing, I think obviously in the North, Tufts, right? They're going to see some pretty good teams in the NCAA tournament, and then they're on a collision course, I think, with RIT, obviously, in the North to meet. And they got a pretty good face-off guy. And it's good to see that Tufts can still win games, even if they're having troubles at the X.
Right. And they will up there. If they see St. John's Fisher with Joe Post, or they see RIT with Nick Montemurano, both of those guys will make you pay at the X if your guy isn't on point. So that's a really good point. And then ultimately in the South, if they do see Salisbury in the championship, they're going to have to deal with Melampi. So those are three very strong face-off guys, none of which are on the Tufts roster. So that'll be something that's really interesting to see how it plays out. Let's go to some more D3 action here before we get to some D2 games and stuff. But I want to stay on D3 for the moment, and let's go to the nice Sunday night nightcap of Lynchburg and Colorado College. I got to catch this game. I was very impressed with the adjustments that Lynchburg has made to their zone offense since the last time that we've had to talk about it, which was great, and it shows on the scoreboard. And I am not as sold as Colorado College as I was following their CNU game and that upset. I know that it was on the heels of CNU losing to Salisbury the day before, but I still walked away from that game believing that Colorado College was a top 20 team, a top 15 team. And in this instance, I feel for Colorado College because they came out east just for one game. It was originally supposed to be for two. They were supposed to come out, play Roanoke and Lynchburg, and I believe they would have beat Roanoke, which would have me saying, like, oh, they're probably still, you know, a pretty solid team, pretty, you know, well solidified in the top 20. And I don't know that they aren't. It's not like losing to Lynchburg says that you're not a top 20 team. There's, you know, lots of teams that have lost to Lynchburg this year that are probably going to end up being ranked at the end of the season. And I think Colorado College is probably one of them. Lynchburg, though, made some adjustments. And ultimately, I think that they have figured out what they want to do with their left-handed attackman, which makes them more dangerous. It spaces the field. It gives them a stretch shooter. That figuring that piece out for them has been huge. And then ultimately, their just depth and athleticism was overpowering. And Colorado College didn't go quietly. You know, they go on a run. They get down 6-2. Lynchburg's up 6-2. And then Colorado College comes back and ties it. And you think for a second, you know, all right, maybe we have a game. But it kind of woke up the Hornets and pushed them and put them into a gear that Colorado College just couldn't match at that point. But it was an interesting game. I'm glad Colorado College got to come out and make it happen, even though that the first game didn't end up coming to fruition for them. But I'm glad that it didn't end up canceling the whole trip in general. Did you get to catch any of this? Any thoughts on this game?
Did not. Wasn't able to catch it, but I think you hit it right on the head with everything you said. I think, you know, Lynchburg is an incredible program, and I think it's good that Colorado College is able to make these trips, you know, and really test themselves on a national scale. And we're just waiting, I think, to see them kind of have that, you know, big program win, you know, against a Lynchburg, or, you know, they were supposed to play Roanoke, over these, per se, maybe Blue Bloods in Division III lacrosse. And right. I think they're certainly capable of it. And, you know, and over the next few years, I think we'll see maybe one of those.
And it's interesting you mention over the next few years, because in order for them to continue to keep getting better, it stems with recruiting, right? This whole thing, every single thing we talk about, all these teams, all these players, it all stems from very first contact you have with them, which is when they're in high school, and it's recruiting, right? And in order to get recruits that you're going to need to win games like that, you have to play teams like that first. And so this is all Colorado College striding in the right direction. Teams getting out east like that from the west is definitely one way to continue to kind of make strides within your program. Cool. I think we hit that game on the head. Let's go ahead and move on to our next game. We'll go to Stevenson versus York, where the Mustangs topped my Spartans 11-8, and I'm going to take 1,000% of the blame. I don't know what else to do at this point besides to just blame the lacrosse gods.
Oh, man.
I came on here. I never do this. I came on this podcast. I came on here, and Kyle Devitt trapped me, my ex-host. I just promised I wouldn't call him his full name. He's my ex-host. Came on here, and he trapped me into talking about how good they are. And then, of course, after I put that into the atmosphere, it comes back to haunt me. And I'll add on to it, at the exact same time, this was a Friday night, 7 o'clock, at the exact same time, my other alma mater, Howard Community College, the old Dragons, went and lost to Essex, which is their rival as well, right? And so it's like, come on, guys. I go 0-2 on the same night. I don't know that either coach needs to do anything besides blame me and just kind of hit the film and readjust, but that's kind of my story, and I'm sticking to it. And I don't know what else to say.
The lacrosse gods, they can be cruel at times. So I get it, Dan.
The lacrosse gods giveth, and sometimes they taketh.
Exactly.
I will give Stevenson some credit. I'm mostly joking. I don't think that the reason that they lost is because of me one entirely. I'll put a little bit on the Stevenson defense that did a pretty good job of getting organized, and they went to a double pull look that kind of threw off York a little bit. And then the other thing that they did is they were just very opportunistic on offense. When they had opportunities, they found the back of the net. And it includes man up when they were able to get hands free. It includes some transition when they were able to get hands free. It includes some late shot clock type stuff when they're like struggling to get anything but kind of force something. And that ended up hitting on for them as well. They had some highlight reel behind the back goal. And you know, it was very Stevenson-y type of game where they hit those. And guess what? I think that I'm 99.9% sure these teams play again. So fortunately for the fans, we get a rematch. These two teams playing never disappoints. Stevenson under the lights, 7 o'clock games. That atmosphere is hard to beat anywhere in Division III lacrosse. So we get another one of those, which is awesome. And I don't know what else to say besides the lacrosse gods were out to get me. But that's kind of how I feel. What about this one for you? Did you have any thoughts on it?
No, I think you hit it right on the head. You know, you probably covered this one a lot more closely than I did, having it be your school and your guys that you pulled for. You know, two great programs, and it's always going to be a battle when they get together. And looking forward to seeing how they progress and finish out this season. And they're always two top dogs in the South. So, you know, expect either of these teams to make a run out of here.
Right. Yep, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see how it happens, see how it all plays out. All we can do is watch at this point, grab your popcorn, and hope it's as entertaining as I think it's going to be. Before we move on, I will shout out one attackman from Stevenson who just eclipsed a milestone. I think it was 100 career points. Jacob Tatum, who is very athletic for his build and his size. He moves a lot better than you're expecting him to when you look at him. So that kind of makes him a really dangerous dodger, but he's really good off the ball. He's a very good player. And so he's somebody that, as we start to talk about All-American type things, that we're going to have to keep his name in the forefront of everything as we keep going forward. So let's go ahead and move on to St. Lawrence and Ithaca, with St. Lawrence 17, Ithaca 7. This is a huge deal as it pertains to the Liberty League, where we have RIT kind of solidified as that number one seed, but then after that, everything's still up in the air. We have St. Lawrence now, who's beat Ithaca. We have Ithaca, who beat Union. We have Union, who beat St. Lawrence. And so within that three-way triangle, we have a bit of uncertainty. And then you go ahead and you take an RPI team that was just kind of lurking in the shadows and practicing and hoping that they get a chance, that just made their debut last Saturday. I actually had the opportunity to talk to Coach over there and put up a story. If you haven't had the chance to go check that out, go ahead and do so. It's really a cool story of resilience and selflessness. And they have a cool thing going over there right now where not just the guys on campus, but their guys remote are at home and cutting up clips and watching huddle and doing scouting reports and stuff like that. And I thought that was really cool. But then he told me that they have attackmen and defensemen who are literally calling and talking and coaching kids filling their own roles. So like starting defenseman who's not back this year because he decided not to go is now coaching the kid younger than him how to do his job better than him. That's amazing. That's amazing. It's awesome.
Yeah, you can't ask for much more than that, I think, from a leadership standpoint. And I think you know, really points out, you know, they got a good thing going over there at RPI, and obviously the culture's intact, and Coach has done a great job with that. So yeah, that's definitely a program, you know, to keep an eye on, especially because that'll pay dividends.
Absolutely. And so we don't know what's going to go on in that league. It's really entertaining. We got to keep watching and keep seeing how that plays out. We do have a matchup in the Liberty League this weekend. We're going to get to a little preview, but we have Union and RIT. So if Union can win that game, it really spices things up. And we have St. Lawrence RPI, where if RPI wins that game, it really spices things up. So we'll see how that goes. Have to see how it all plays out. And then the other thing that's relevant to this St. Lawrence-Ithaca game is that it is Coach Mahoney's 250th win. So congratulations to Coach. That's quite the milestone. 250 wins, man. It's a lot. Coach Cadell could just hit 300 as well. We talked about that last week, or would have talked about that last week, but it was in our roundup. So congratulations to those coaches who are hitting those milestones. All right. Let's move away from D3 a little bit here and head to Division 2 for a little bit of action as we recap some games. And the most intriguing one to me is the SAC championship, Lenoir Ryan 19, Wingate 14. And then for Wingate to get there, Wingate had to beat Limestone 14-10, which was the second time they beat them this year. Really interesting how that all played out. I was pulling for Wingate. I thought that Wingate had a cool story going. I was hoping they were going to pull that out. I will admit that, hands up. Another team of mine that I was pulling for this weekend that suffered a loss. So if Wingate, you want to go ahead and blame me as well, feel free. I'm just taking it all.
I love it. Yeah. No, this has been interesting too, because typically I don't follow the D2 landscape as closely, but my high school goalie, my senior year, I'll give a quick shout out to Brendan Grove. He's a freshman on the team there this year. So I've been following them and their progress a little bit. It's been really awesome to see Wingate kind of emerge as one of the top dogs in D2 this year. And I was pulling for him as well. So
yes,
I guess I can take part of the blame for that as well. You take all of it.
I'll take most of it and give you just a little bit. And then it's interesting you mentioned them. I do want to hit the SAC awards as well. Coach Boyle at Wingate did go ahead and was granted as the coach of the year in their conference, in the SAC conference. They were 10-1 at the time of the awards being granted, and had also beat Lenoir Rhyne in their first matchup, 16-15, which could be the potential game of the year. We'll have to see how the rest of the season plays out, but that was a interesting one. And I took the last week or so to kind of dive in after Kyle's departure, who was handling most of the Division II stuff on our side. And so I'm going to try and continue to be a voice for Division II and continue to talk about it and do a little bit more with it myself, in the absence of Kyle. And then the other awards that I want to talk about within that, Eric Dickinson, Lenoir Rhyne, he was granted as the player of the year. And then Cam Weeks from Anderson, face-off guy, as the freshman of the year. And listen to these stats. Cam was 208 for 286.
Holy moly.
At 72%. That's not just incredible for that's incredible for like a fifth-year senior that's been doing it, that was like a returning All-American. Yeah. It's incredible for a freshman. It's nuts.
It's incredible. Any class year, any division, like you put up those stats, you're a stud. So definitely a kid to keep an eye on over the years. And I mean, you got to think stats like that, any level for a face-off guy, maybe has a career past his 4 years.
You're not wrong at all. And I will tell you this. You mentioned having an eye on him for the next couple of years. I am not one of few, meaning there are a lot of people that were in my boat a couple years ago, as in they were on the recruiting trail and watching Cam Weeks tear it up, saying, like, I would take this kid, And Cam had a lot of offers. Cam had a lot of popularity in high school as out of recruiting. He's from South Carolina, so it made it a little bit more of a harder find, but he ended up at Anderson, and when that happened, I was like, oh my god, like he might not lose a faceoff. And then apparently he won 72% of them, so yeah, I was exaggerating a little bit. Only a little bit.
38% of the faceoffs.
Right.
Or 28, sorry. Not a math major.
Yeah, me either. I wouldn't have even caught it. I would have let you go with it. All right, and then on to the Conference Carolinas with the with Belmont Abbey winning 12-7 over Mount Olive. I did not get to catch this game live. I did get to go back and watch a bit of it. It was about as entertaining as a 12-7 game could be, but it was a good one, and it was one that I it was exciting. Again, it was about as exciting as a 12-7 game could be. And that's kind of how I feel about it. Belmont Abbey is interesting, though, because they have a whole bunch of seniors in this class coming into the season. They had a bit of hype around them because they were supposed to be old and experienced. And so it doesn't surprise me that they were able to kind of put it together, make a run, and end up raising the flag at the end of the year.
Perfect. All right. Hit it right on the head. Yeah, didn't see that one either.
All right, let's go ahead and get to a bit of a weekend preview. All right, we have a few marquee, big Division III matchups. And I'm going to start with Gettysburg F&M. I think in my eyes, this is the game of the weekend. You could convince me that there's some other ones because of some of the northern stuff that's going on. But this is going to determine the Centennial champion and subsequently grant a bid. And I could not be more excited for this one. These are two teams that don't particularly like each other. They are extremely similar, right? Both schools are very similar, high academic, a little bit high cost institutions that attract similar players. And they all get recruited to the same school, you know, and it's kind of, I mean, I said not all, but a lot of them get recruited to both schools. The assistant coaches both have Lynchburg ties and are friends dating back for years and years and years, which is interesting. One more just, I would say, tie to this game that is kind of fun to watch and just makes for a really entertaining game. I don't know who's going to win. I think FNM is a little bit better. They're both undefeated, but I don't know who's going to win. Whoever game plans and executes better is going to win, which like is the biggest cop-out of a take of all time. But it's the God's honest truth, and I don't know who it is. I think they're two really evenly matched teams. They're both pretty good defensively. They're similar on offense. I think Luke Keating is playing really, really well for FNM, and I think Gettysburg is getting similar performances out of a combination of guys between Jack Fletcher and then in the midfield. I always call him Ryan Howard, but I think that's a baseball player.
it is, Phillies.
And they're playing really, really well, so I don't know who's going to win. I'm really excited to catch it, though. It's kind of been on the surface as, like, a collision course since they both kind of took care of your sinus, but I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really excited to see if – I think this would be a big program win if FNM can get it, kind of get over that hump of beating a team like Gettysburg and – taking control of that conference, which, you know, Gettysburg, I would say, is historically kind of the top dog there. So I think I've been able to catch FNM play a couple times this year. You already mentioned it. I think Luke Keating's playing terrific right now. And I think he's got a lot of capable surrounding guys to can also contribute to a potential FNM win this weekend. So definitely one to keep an eye on. I think you hit it right on the head.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. I was close. It's Kyle Howard, which is why I always think it's Ryan. It's a different four-letter name that rolls off the tongue better. And for whatever reason, I think of the home run there.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah, everybody knew who I was talking about. Come
exactly.
on. The next game on the docket I want to get to is Lynchburg Hampton Sydney. We have a similar triangle tie going on, except it's not for second place like it is in the Liberty League. It's for first place going on in the ODAC. And so if Lynchburg is to beat Hampton Sydney this weekend, that would mean that Hampton Sydney's beat WNL, WNL beat Lynchburg. And again, they played twice. They played back-to-back, but the first game was the one that counted for the conference, and that was the one that WNL won. So technically in conference, WNL's beaten Lynchburg. Lynchburg will have beaten Hampton Sydney if that comes to fruition this weekend. Otherwise, it's not an issue at all. If Hampton Sydney wins, they're just the one seed. They beat Lynchburg and WNL. Then WNL is the two because they beat Lynchburg in the head-to-head. But if it does end up happening where Lynchburg beats Hampton Sydney, then we'll have that three-way tie, and it comes down to winning percentage, which is interesting. Because it's extra intriguing because Lynchburg has played one less game. They were not able to reschedule their Virginia Wesleyan game. So if Lynchburg does end up beating Hampton Sydney, they could end up being the three seed in the ODAC as the highest ranked nationally team of the three, which is interesting. But I don't know that it is something that will stop them from winning the ODAC. I honestly think they have a better chance of winning the ODAC if they end up as the third seed because they'll use it as some sort of chip. Coach Kadelka will use it as like a motivating factor, and they'll like crush both teams. That's kind of how I see it playing out if they do end up as the third seed. But if they end up as the first seed, maybe they, you know, take a nap or something on one of those games. But if they end up as the third seed, they're destined to just go win the ODAC.
Do you think that's a multi-bid league?
Oh, that's a great question. It's really tough. I ultimately think that if Hampton Sydney had beat CNU early in the year, or Lynchburg had beat them twice, then yes. But right now, I don't think that's the case.
Fair. Okay.
All right, let's head up your way for a couple weekend previews. We'll start first with St. Lawrence RPI, which we already kind of talked about. Any thoughts on this one, how it plays out, or anything of that nature?
Yeah, I mean, big St. Lawrence obviously coming off a big win. It was great to see Jack Hennessy, senior attackman for St. Lawrence, step up. Big game last week, 6 goals. Helped them go on that big run they had in the second and third quarter. But like we were saying earlier, RPI is a very capable opponent that, you know, it's kind of almost like this is not the team that you want to play coming off a big win, right? You're riding all high and everything. And then there's RPI who's kind of flying under the radar a little bit. And they can catch you if you're sleeping. So, in this league, Liberty League, it's a battle every week. You know, any given Saturday, I think it'll be definitely a game to keep an eye on. Dan, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think your point is poignant, and I think that it's really interesting the difference in scout that's going to be able to go into this game. RPI is going to be able to go into this game with 5-6 games, however many St. Lawrence has played at this point, maybe more games of scout. And right. Be able to come up with something that, you know, can really, really disrupt them. Whereas St. Lawrence is going to be going into it somewhat blind. They'll have 2 games under their belt because at this point, RPI will have played Union as well as their opening game. And so they'll have 2 games to be able to use a scout, which I don't think means nothing, you know, and maybe they can put something in or sneak up on them, or there's something that, you know, St. Lawrence just hasn't seen and therefore can't prepare for. So that's something to watch for. And then the other battle up there in that league is Union RIT. Man, if Union can win this game, it would really spice things up for that league. And just, I root for chaos in general. So
absolutely.
So if that means that I want Union to win so that there's extra chaos, then sure, like, call me the crazy guy that wants all the chaos, but that's exactly what I want.
Yeah, and I think Union, last couple games too, which I've been able to catch some of their games, and towards the beginning of the year, pretty much I would say a lot of the offense was running through the attack, and in the last couple games, there's been some good scoring from the midfield, which has been nice to see. I think they're playing kind of more complimentary team lacrosse right now. So I think they're kind of getting, you know, they had the hiccup against Ithaca, 1-goal game. But watching that game live, just one guy to keep an eye on, I would say, is Aiden Flood. He's a midfielder. He seems to be the spark plug for this Union offense. Every time he scores, the bench is going nuts. His teammates are getting up for him. So look for that name, I think, to get this team going this weekend against RIT. Any given Saturday in the Liberty League. So, it would be certainly an upset if they can pull this one off, but it wouldn't be the most shocking thing in the world, just given the nature of the league.
Totally. And they have had some really close battles with them in the past. They lost to them 3 times in 2019, but all of them were close. All of them. It may have been one goal game.
This team's itching for a win against these guys.
And they've been knocking on the door, so perhaps this is the time where they get over the hump. That'll be really interesting to watch. And it's funny you mentioned a midfielder for Union. Union may have one of the better midfields in the country, because I also like their lefty, Kieran McGovern.
Yes.
He's slick and crafty and does a good job of initiating the offense over on that left wing. And he can get topside on you, or he can take you underneath and hit an upfield shoulder. And that midfield is pretty legit over there.
Yeah, they're starting to play a complete game. So, look out for this team going forward. Absolutely.
Right. And then if RIT comes out and just absolutely crushes them, then we'll be able to just be like, well, RIT is such a wagon.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. We could totally hop on that bandwagon for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think that will do it for this edition of the D2, D3 podcast. Thanks so much for joining. I hope you enjoyed the listen. I am Dan Kaplan, and you can always find me on Twitter at dkaplan46. And this is Jack Raba, and you can always find him on Twitter at
JackRaba24.
Boom. There it is. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Have a great rest of your day, night, life, year, weekend, whatever it is. Until the next time, we hopefully talk to you.
Appreciate that.